You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Cordelia Lynch, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Martin Plaut, a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Martin, what do you have for us?
Well, how many women should there be on boards in Britain, in Europe's companies? There's an aim to have 40% by the year 2020. Can it be achieved?
Or more from Martin later, also coming up. It was the attack that almost killed Yemen's then head of state in the rocket attack on the presidential palace in 2011. We'll ask why the trial of those accused of carrying it out is increasingly dividing opinion across the country.
Also ahead, we'll continue our series on the purveyors of soft power around the world to complement Monocle's annual soft power survey. Today, we'll be discussing this man.
At the beginning, I had no idea whether a discovery would be made in my lifetime.
Professor Peter Higgs, the pioneer who discovered the so-called God particle and won the Nobel Prize for his efforts.
He's carried his fame very lightly, and he's been an effective and worthwhile ambassador for British research around the world.
And before the end of the programme,
I had this brainstorming as I said to the person next to me, this packing is killing me. You know, my back hurts. This is killing my knees on this hard cement floor. And the person said, yeah, I know what you mean. And I said, you know what we need? This is my brilliant insight. We need knee pads.
We'll meet the prize-winning author of a new book on Amazon founder Jeff Bezos.
All that with one click and some music on Super Saver Delivery if you order in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. At least 10 Egyptian soldiers have been killed and 35 more injured in a car bombing near the city of El Arish in North Sinai. They were travelling in a convoy on the road to the Rafah border crossing with Gaza. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. In a separate incident on Wednesday, three people were injured in a bomb attack on a security checkpoint in Cairo. President Obama has urged Congress to hold off on tightening sanctions against Iran while talks about its nuclear program continue. He warned lawmakers that Tehran would make progress in its ability to build a nuclear weapon if there's no diplomatic deal to halt or roll back the nuclear process. Diplomats are due in Geneva for a third round of talks today, with members of Congress debating behind closed doors whether to go ahead with the new set of stricter economic sanctions. The president says he hopes a deal can be reached.
In part because the sanctions have been so effective, we were able to get Iran to seriously come to the table and look at how are they going to give assurances to the international community that they are in fact not pursuing a nuclear weapons program. I don't know if we'll be able to close a deal this week or next week. We have been very firm with the Iranians, even on the interim deal, about what we expect.
A white supremacist serial killer has been given a stay of execution just hours before he was due to be put to death by lethal injection in Missouri. 63-year-old Joseph Franklin was sentenced to death for killing one man and wounding two others outside a synagogue in 1977. He was also convicted of a series of other racially motivated murders, and he confessed to the shooting of the pornography publisher Larry Flint, who was left partially paralysed. A federal judge granted the stay of execution following legal challenges over the use of a new drug in the lethal injection process. US border authorities have announced that they've seized a record haul of 20,000 pounds of marijuana hidden in a produce truck entering Arizona from Mexico. The seizure at the Mariposa port of entry near Nogales was reported to have a street value of $10 million. A decade after banning smoking in bars and restaurants, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has banned the sale of cigarettes and tobacco products to those under 21 years of age. For most of the country, the legal age to purchase and consume tobacco is 18, but some states and counties have adopted 19 years of age. In one Boston suburb, the age limit was raised to 21 in 2005. New York will be the first large city in the US to prevent the sale of cigarettes and tobacco to those under the age of 21.
People always try to put things like selling cigarettes in the context of jobs and whether or not it helps or hurts stores. I think that is just so outrageously misplaced. This isn't the issue of whether we're going to kill people. This century, 1 billion people will die from smoking around the world. And we don't want any of the people that die to be New Yorkers. That's the one thing we can do. And the people that try to change the argument to an economic one really ought to look in a mirror and be ashamed.
With just 41 days to go before the new year begins, one British calendar for 2014 has still failed to sell a single copy since going on sale in September. Fast Disappearing Telephone Boxes of Wales features 12 photos of dilapidated phone booths and costs £9.99. Publisher Kevin Beresford, who had a huge success with his Roundabouts of Great Britain 2012 calendar, admits that this year's creation is so humdrum, naff, nerdy and dull that not even the most patriotic Welsh person wants to buy it. He says he may have crossed a boring bridge too far. Thomas Lewis cheering in there. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
And that's the issue with having a Welsh producer, I think. Thanks very much, Barney Burnham.
Maybe you should do public toilets next year.
It's 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Well, time now to set the day's news agenda, with the key stories we'll be tracking throughout the day. And joining us is Martin Plaut, a fellow at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies. Martin, welcome.
Thanks very much.
We'll start with an interesting list of Britain's new apparent best friends in Africa and some surprises making the cut.
Well, there are indeed. Would you have assumed that Tanzania, Angola, Mozambique, Ivory Coast and Ghana were at the top of London's list? I mean, to be high-level prosperity development partnerships? I mean, it is not the obvious list of targets.
Well, it is partly surprising, but I wonder how much this is an attempt to divert from the usual suspects and to look at new aspects and you know, resources.
Be completely cynical, I think we have to look at what their resources are.
Indeed. I mean, you would have assumed that somewhere like, you know, South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, which are the main trading partners for Britain in Africa, would have been there. But no, as you say, it is the resources that they have, Georgina. It's the hydrocarbons. You have Angola, which is, of course, a very well-developed oil industry. And then you have Mozambique, which is now a lot of gas, and Ghana, which is a lot of oil as well. Organisations like Tullo Oil, which are based in London, have a big stake there, and Ivory Coast, where they've just discovered new deposits of gas off the coast.
But none of these countries, or many of these countries, have less than perfect records. I mean, if you're looking at Cote d'Ivoire, I mean, their former leaders up in The Hague for, you know, crimes there, and Mozambique, of course, facing new problems with RENAMO. Is this going to be difficult for London?
I think it will. But, you know, I suppose Mark Simmons, who is the Africa minister, I saw him yesterday morning over breakfast, bacon and eggs in the Strand. And basically he was arguing, we've got to take risks. We've got to go out there and we've got to win new markets. And we want Africa to succeed. Africa is succeeding. He then went on to also list all the corruption and crime and all those kind of things. But he was talking about how Africa is in a big and important partner.
Well, it begs the question then, what will DFID's involvement be in this?
Exactly, because the development budget is now looks as if it's also going to be used to buttress British investments. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of people in the aid industry who are already worried about the fact that aid money is now being used to support military ends. Now it's going to be used for investment ends. I suppose in a way this is a way that David Cameron, the Prime Minister, can sell the idea of putting more and more money into development, as if you can say, well, we can also use it for these purposes, which help us back home. So I suppose that's the reason.
How much of this is driven by China, though? Because, of course, there is this huge news scramble for Africa going on. I mean, high-level prosperity partnerships in Africa, colonisation by any other name?
Well, exactly. I mean, the Chinese have been putting huge resources. I mean, it was absolutely fascinating. About 10 years ago, I noticed that you were having vice presidents of China traveling across Africa. They have massive resources. They also have, you have the Chinese television and radio stations are all investing in Africa and broadcasting to Africa from Kenya, doing extremely well. They have bureaus across the continent, many more bureaus than I would say all of Western reporters in Africa. There are many more Chinese than there are Western reporters across the whole continent.
And the investment in infrastructure enormous. I mean, we've seen over the past decades roads and railways.
And those wonderful little stadiums.
Indeed. Well, moving on to another topic of the Ethiopian Prime Minister, who's in Kuwait for the Africa Arab Summit, and a plenty to discuss there. Not least Ethiopians being repatriated from Saudi Arabia, telling tales of beatings and imprisonment there.
And worse, this looks as if about three Ethiopians were killed when they protested at being thrown out of the country. The Ethiopians who work and live in Saudi Arabia are appallingly treated. Very often they're almost held as hostages in the country, because once they get there, they have to be sponsored by somebody. Their passports are taken away. They are almost imprisoned by their employers. And those people who've come across as refugees, and a lot of people do, they come across the Red Sea in hope of getting better work or conditions, they are in an even worse position. Now, the Ethiopians have sent a minister over to try and get 40,000 people back from Saudi Arabia. Now, of course, it'd be really tough for them as well.
I mean, many of the Ethiopians there are accusing their own government of not doing enough. They're saying their own embassy won't help them. They've demonstrated back home in Addis and had riot police called out to disperse
indeed,
them.
Indeed, and not just in Addis. There were big demonstrations in America, in Germany, and across the rest of Europe by Ethiopians who say, look, you're not helping us. And I suppose this is the thing that Prime Minister Haile Mariam will have to be taking up with his Saudi counterparts when he's in Kuwait today.
Yeah. Martin, let's move on just briefly. I want to have a look at the Iran deal still on the table in Geneva. Of course, that meeting also ongoing at the moment. But what kind of hope are we still holding out here?
Well, there is, of course, a hope, and it would be a biggie if it comes off. John Kerry, the Secretary of State, has been pushing incredibly hard, as has President Obama, and it is close. The difficulty is, of course, that it comes in the teeth of opposition, not just from the Israelis, who are very, very sceptical about the Iranians and any deal with them, particularly the lifting of the sanctions against Iran and the fact that there's $10 billion of money which is being tied up. Now, that is what's on the table. But will it get through? And will it get through Congress, even if it is supported? That is going to be really hard.
And, of course, this happens amidst a backdrop of increasing tensions as well, we see in the Middle East.
Indeed. And, that is the other issue. The sceptics are saying, well, you are saying that you can lift these sanctions but could always put them back on again. Mm. There's no history of sanctions ever being put on once they've been taken off.
Martin, very quickly, girl power.
Well, yes. Are we going to see Vivian Redding, the justice commissioner in Europe, being able to push through the idea that there should be 40% of women on corporate boards by 2020. There already are 35% in Norway, but in Britain, it's just 19%, which is pretty ridiculous. But frankly, if the women were anything like both of you, I can't imagine that any board would resist you.
Well, they're talking about actually legislating for it in Germany. And so at this point, we do have to sideline you. And Cordelia and I need to look at this. Would you want to be on the board of a company that was forced to have you? How would it be working in that kind of environment?
Well, exactly. And it harks back to kind of 60s America as well, when you saw Black African Americans being bought into colleges and quotas, then kind of backlash you get from that. And I think it's a sense I'd certainly be offended that I was there by legislative reasons and not through selection of talent. So
how likely do you think this is to go through, Martin?
I would think it will have a chance. Yes, I do think it is a possibility. There is the wind is in the favor in the sails, shall we say. I think that people are moving in this direction. Of course, there's one other question that they're going to be looking at in Europe, and that is, should they be going every month to Strasbourg? That huge waste of money. Mm. So there are a couple of big issues on the European table today.
Absolutely. Well, Martin Plaut, a fellow of the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll be in Yemen and the trial that has stalled for one of the defining moments of the Arab Spring.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
Now in Yemen, for over 2 years, five men have been detained awaiting trial in connection with the bombing of the presidential palace mosque in June 2011.
The alleged attempted assassination of the former president Ali Abdullah Saleh is at the heart of it. Seven people died in the explosion and others were seriously injured, including Saleh. But the trial has been beset by delays, and lawyers on both sides say political pressure has clouded the judicial process.
The assassination was a key moment of the Arab Spring, but Ali Abdullah Saleh returned to Yemen, which secured his safe departure from office. Well, joining us now to discuss this further is journalist Iona Craig. Iona, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Who's responsible for the delays in this trial? Both sides seeming to blame different people.
Yes, of course, as you mentioned, this is a highly political case, and the judicial system here has always been very politicised as well. Now we're at the stage where they're calling for a new judge to be appointed because the one who was presiding supposedly over the case can't be claimed as independent by either side. So that's the latest delay. But as you say, these now five men, sort of whittled down from an original 32 people that were arrested in connection with this case, have been held since 2011 without trial and claim that they've also been tortured in that process.
What influence, Iona, does Saleh still have?
Well, of course, geographically, he's still in the country, living in Sana'a, which is a fairly unique case amongst the Arab Spring countries. And his influence, of course, is still widespread. He was in charge in power here for more than 30 years. He is still being blamed very heavily by many people here, including the UN envoy who's in charge of the transition, Jamal Benamar, who made statements in the last few days condemning sort of Saleh and his meddling still within the transition process. And he's still involved in politics. He's still head of the GPC, the party that he set up here in Yemen. So, yes, he's definitely not retired.
And Iona, how destabilising are the delays to the trial in the country?
Well, of course, you know, it's a lot of... Certainly the lawyer that's involved in bringing this case, he claims... Mohamed Maswari, the lawyer in charge of prosecuting, he claims that this case is linked to ISLA, Yemen's Muslim Brotherhood party. So, of course, it's very highly political. You're blaming opposition leaders for carrying out this bombing and killing and attempting to kill Ali Abdullah Saleh. So it's a very, very sensitive issue. In the meantime, there was an alleged attempt against the new president, President Hadi's life, earlier this year, and that case went to trial and is already being heard in court now. Alleged Al-Qaeda members who planted an IED earlier this year near the president's house. That is going along as it should, whereas this case has been delayed now for 2 years, and whether it'll ever really come to trial and we'll find out what went on is probably highly unlikely.
Because, of course, although Yemen is signed up to Article 14 of the UN Covenant, which stipulates a trial must commence without undue delay, they've got no domestic law that actually says that in any way.
That's a problem with a lot of things in Yemen. And in the past, the government here and Ali Abdullah Saleh himself was very quick to sign up to a lot of international treaties, but were rarely implemented here. In fact, Yemen always had a pretty good constitution, but again, it wasn't really implemented. So that's not uncommon. And as I say, as the delay continues, it antagonizes, you know, particularly one side, those supporters of Ali Abdullah Saleh who are seeking justice. And it adds to the political tension here that we're experiencing anyway, is this transition period for Yemen is being continually delayed along with this trial.
And this happens, of course, in tandem with another trial, 9 men accused of assassinating the current president.
Yes, exactly. As I say, I mean, that trial is actually going through the process that it should be, in the sense that the first hearings have already occurred here in Sana'a. And, you know, the case has only been running over this year. So the assassination attempt, an apparent IED that was planted near the president's house, was found, the men were arrested, and, you know, they have been already put, their trial has already begun here in Sana'a, unlike this case from 2011, which has got a much more political angle to it, with the assassination attempt against Hadi. Those are accused of being Al-Qaeda members, whereas with the case against Ali Abdullah Saleh, the accusations are being made against what was then the political opposition.
Now, you mentioned Al-Qaeda, and Yemen is battling one of the most active franchises of Al-Qaeda. Is there hope of progress in that fight?
The biggest problem in Yemen at the moment with the issue of Al-Qaeda is the general breakdown in security and the lack of government control, the lack of rule of law. And that has, we've seen, you know, worsening over the last 2 years since the so-called Arab Spring in 2011 and the transition process here. The security situation has gradually declined and got worse and worse. So we're seeing a rise in local Al-Qaeda activity in Yemen, but not just that, in a general breakdown of law and order. So you're talking about, you know, tribal conflicts. You're talking about attacks against the electricity infrastructure here. We've got an ongoing conflict in the north at the moment, which is highly politicized as well. And, you know, an increase in kidnappings of both Yemenis and as well as foreigners that are not linked to al-Qaeda. This is just general security issues where you've seen influence within the military, where there's restructuring attempts have been made, and this has a knock-on effect to the general security around the country as things become less stable than they even were before, and government control is receding even further as we speak, really.
Lots of challenges ahead, Iona. Thank you very much indeed. That was the journalist Iona Craig in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a.
Stay tuned. We're off to Paris next. It's 9:24 in Paris, 8:24 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin, and Cordelia Lynch.
Well, time now to check in with our man in Paris. And joining us today is our correspondent there, Tom Burgess-Watson. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Good morning to you both.
Good morning. And we start with that massive manhunt underway for the Paris gunman and a motive seeking to be established at the moment.
Yes, lots and lots of questions and really very few answers at this stage, as that manhunt is still absolutely underway in the French capital. This is, just to remind you, a man who shot a photographer at the offices of one of the most read newspapers in France called Libération. He stormed in and he shot at almost point-blank range a young photographer who was turning up his first day at work there on Monday morning. And he then went on to another part of Paris, to La Défense, which is where the banks all are. He stormed inside the headquarters of Société Générale, one of the biggest banks in France. And then he carjacked a car, went down the Champs-Élysées and vanished into the metro. And that was the last anyone's seen of him. But the result is people are very concerned, especially in the media, because they think he could be the same man who stormed into BFM television studios last week and threatened staff there with a gun. I didn't shoot anybody, in fact, that time. But he said next time he won't miss them as he fired shots into the air. The Interior Minister saying that this is a very dangerous situation. The French President saying he could strike at any time. And for the time being, as you said, very little information. We do have his DNA, curiously enough, and we know a little bit about what he looks like. He's said to have been of European appearance, between 35 and 45 years of age, and he's thought to have been a lone operator. And as for a motive, well, the newspaper that he struck on Monday had been very much criticizing how France was becoming increasingly a racist country, and their front cover last week simply read assez, meaning that's enough. So is there a possible motive there? Could he have far right extremist leanings? We don't know. There are purely theories out there at the moment and nothing concrete.
And racism, as you say, one of those possible theories. Well, racism is something that seems to be coming up a lot here. A big racist front cover in a magazine this week too.
This is astonishing, a really shocking story, and it's even had the United Nations weighing in, warning that xenophobia and intolerance are on the rise in Europe, and criticizing specifically the article, the headline that you're referring to, which was on the front cover of a magazine called Minute, and it showed the Justice Minister, Christiane Taubira, not for the first time, I should add, the target of profoundly shocking racist language. The front cover showed her, and it said in offensive words beside her, crafty as a monkey, Taubira gets her banana back. Now, there is a play on words in here. Getting your banana back in French is said to be a way of saying to put a smile back on your face. But clearly, this is racist intent, and the Justice Minister had, in fact, warned in the last few weeks that racist language appears no longer to be a taboo in France, and she blamed the far-right parties for helping to allow hateful language to sort of creep into daily parlance. But there are also statistics to back up this argument that it's something that's returning very curiously. In the year 2013, there has been a sharp jump in racist acts being reported to the police. And it's very surprising because this is a multicultural, multi-ethnic country. It has been for a very long time. And, well, the winner in this particular case seems to be the justice minister herself. Christiane Taubira has emerged the stronger. There's been a huge sense of outrage, lots of solidarity for her amongst her parliamentary colleagues and the public. And she isn't taking legal action, so she seems to be rising above it.
Well, something that's also rising is a dangerous sense of climate of civil unrest, and Hollande has been booed recently as well.
Yeah, extraordinary scenes on the Champs-Élysées last week when Hollande visited the tomb of the unknown soldier, and people chanted Hollande out, calling him a dictator. But there was a report leaked to the press on Thursday, regional prefectural officers saying that there's a risk of civil unrest here in France, and it's mainly derived from the anger at rising taxes. All of us have seen our tax bills shoot up in the last 6 to 12 months. And France is now the second most taxed country in Europe. So it's an expensive place to live, and people's salaries aren't rising correspondingly. And that might be very well part of the reason why a recent YouGov poll only gave 15% approval to the president. That's the most unpopular president of modern times, François Hollande. There are calls for the prime minister, Jean-Marc Ayrault, to leave, and calls for a reshuffle. And if there is a reshuffle, it might actually be too late, because there are municipal elections on track for March, European elections in May. So if they do reshuffle, it's extremely bad timing. So a very strange sense of anger here in France.
Indeed. Tom Burgess-Watson, Monocle's Paris correspondent, thank you very much again.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll speak to Brad Stone, author of the prize-winning The Everything Store, a profile of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Cordelia. At least 10 Egyptian soldiers have been killed and 35 more injured in a car bombing near the city of El Arish in North Sinai. They were travelling in a convoy on the road to the Rafah border crossing with Gaza. President Obama has urged Congress to hold off on tightening sanctions against Iran while talks about its nuclear program continue. Diplomats are due in Geneva for a third round of talks today. A white supremacist serial killer has been given a stay of execution just hours before he was due to be put to death by lethal injection in Missouri. 63-year-old Joseph Franklin was convicted of a series of racially motivated murders in the 1970s. US border authorities have announced that they've seized a record haul of 20,000 pounds of marijuana hidden in a produce truck entering Arizona from Mexico. The seizure is reported to have a street value of $10 million. A decade after banning smoking in bars and restaurants, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has banned the sale of cigarettes and tobacco products to those under 21. For most of the country, the legal age for purchasing and consuming tobacco is 18 years old. And with just 41 days to go before the new year begins, one British 2014 calendar has still failed to sell a single copy since going on sale in September. Fast Disappearing Telephone Boxes of Wales costs £9.99. Its publisher admits that it's so humdrum, naff, nerdy and dull that not even the most patriotic Welsh person wants to buy it. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
It's 10:32 in Beirut, 9:32 in Munich and 8:32 here in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin and Cordelia Lynch. Now, in this week's series, we're taking a look at soft power superstars around the world to coincide with Monocle's annual soft power survey. Nations are increasingly trying to get what they want through attraction rather than coercion, looking beyond military might to exert a more nuanced influence on the world stage. Well-known figures and brands serve as one means of garnering global attention.
Today we're in the UK to recognise the work of this man.
At the beginning, I had no idea whether a discovery would be made in my lifetime.
Well, that was Professor Peter Higgs, the pioneer who discovered the so-called God particle and won the Nobel Prize for his efforts. Through this accolade, Higgs has become an icon in the UK, a rare feat for a scientist, often overshadowed by more prominent figures from pop culture and sport. Well, can Higgs change the way others look at the UK? And is he a good soft power ambassador for the country? To find out more, Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards spoke to science journalist David Whitehouse.
I think there are several reasons why Peter Higgs is to be admired, not least, of course, because of his work on the Higgs boson, for which he's recently got the Nobel Prize. But I think that his longevity and his interest over a long period and his work for which he got the Nobel Prize was done 40 years ago. And it was a brief spurt, if you like, of interest in a particular area of science. And he's been world famous for that research, although nobody knew if his particle or his predictions would ever be borne out until they were found last year. He was world famous for that, and I think he's carried his fame and the question over whether or not his work would be proven right or wrong eventually. He's carried his fame very lightly, and he's been an effective and worthwhile ambassador for British research around the world. Wherever he's been asked to travel to and to talk, he's been very self-effacing, but certainly very definite about the fact that the type of research he's involved in, the research that might not have any practical applications ever, purely for the interest, purely for the cultural aspect of finding out about the universe we live in. He's been an ambassador for saying that is very important.
And David, it's interesting, isn't it? I guess the wider point there, that science, research and development, certain cutting-edge technologies in these kind of areas really still mark out the United Kingdom. There is still a real expertise here, isn't there? Not just in the sort of the ivory towers of academia and places where Peter Higgs works, but sort of throughout a lot of industry and business, the UK is pretty good at softly raising its voice in these kind of areas, isn't it?
We've got a lot to shout about. We've got a lot to be very proud of. Science-wise, we produce the second most science in the world, only after America. And in fact, per head of population, we're more effective than America at science. And that's just not physics like Peter Higgs produces. It's genetics, it's environment science, it's any science you care to mention. We have more than our fair share of world's experts. But also the technology and the engineering, I feel, often doesn't get media attention. We have the best engineers in the world. If anybody in the world wants to build a bridge or build a tunnel or do anything in large-scale engineering, there are Britons all over that project because we are so good at that. And I think that's why Peter Higgs is and others like him are such good ambassadors, because they show that these things, these difficult things, are open to anybody. Peter Higgs didn't have a privileged or special background, and yet his interest took him to the edge of understanding the universe. And there are many people who study engineering, who study mathematics, who study all sorts of things, are doing absolutely remarkable things. And if I have one criticism of the media today, is that we don't hear about the real heroes, like Peter Higgs and the engineers and the scientists. We hear about the celebrities who really haven't done very much, or if they have done something, it pales into social insignificance compared to the real heroes who are building the world we live in and designing the world we live in the future.
Let's talk a little bit more about Peter Higgs, the man. You mentioned how well he wore the sort of the fame and this reputation that he had for his brilliance in physics. Do you think that's a trait that not only Peter Higgs has, but throughout the science community? You mentioned we've got lots of things we should shout about. Do you think perhaps the UK does a good enough job at doing exactly that, at raising its voice, at saying, look, you know, we do have all this expertise, give us a little bit of credit for it? Do you think perhaps it's a slightly self-effacing quality? Perhaps the UK would rather wear these honours in a slightly more discreet way?
Well, it's a very mixed bag in the sense that I don't think, I think Peter Higgs would probably agree with me on this, that science has its rightful place in society, if you like. I don't think it's as well represented in the media and in general culture as much as it should. Science is more important than playing football. It's more important than music. It's more important than many things, and it should sit alongside people's interest in sport and music and art more prominently than it does. Science is often used in the news media as entertainment. You know, we've found a new planet, we've found a new particle, or guess what they're up to now. And I think that the sort of science that is done every day, the science which is more practical and more important for people who live, the science of food technology, the science of transport, the science of materials, the science of all these things don't get reported enough, and they don't have their place in our cultural life. We all know about the latest pop song. We all know about the exploits of the national athletics, football, cricket, rugby teams. But it's very rare you hear about some amazing science that's been done into genetics, into understanding ourselves, into producing new ways to transport vaccines, new ways to preserve foods, new ways to build better computers. It seems to me that that's not recognised enough. And I remember going to a lecture that Peter Higgs gave, about 20 years ago, when he was well known among the science community, but he wasn't as well known among the public. And he was saying that, you know, within my lifetime, hopefully my research will become better known, but it will only make sense if all this other research is known about at the same time. You don't just chop off the top of the mountain and ignore the rest of the research which is done. And I think that was a good lesson. I think the scientific community has its role to play, and it has its shortcomings. But I also think the media should pay more attention not to the gee whiz pinnacle of the top of the mountain of science, but the bottom, the more other areas of science which affect people's everyday lives. Because let's face it, the Higgs boson doesn't affect you or me at all. It's a bit of fun. It's a bit of enjoying the universe. And yet new ways to build computers, preserve food, to drive our cars, to stop pollution, they often don't get mentioned, and they're much more affecting to you and I.
Well, that was Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards speaking to science journalist David Whitehouse. And don't forget to pick up the latest edition of Monocle magazine, which includes our annual Soft Power Survey. We take a look at 30 countries who best attract favour from other nations through culture, sport, cuisine, design, diplomacy and beyond.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this to hear from the author of The Everything Store.
They are the eyes and the ears that follow the most powerful politician in the world.
Good afternoon, everybody. I am eager to take your questions.
They're the witnesses to some of the most pivotal moments in U.S. history.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Today, our nation saw evil, the very worst of human nature, and we responded with the best of America.
It's been a long time coming, but tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
All this week on The Globalist and The Globalist Asia, we meet the members of the White House press pool, the reporters who cover events from the center of political life in the U.S., and who get closer than anyone else to the commander-in-chief. We'll hear from those who saw presidents rise.
President Bush came to office with a simple set of policy goals, chief among them a reduction in taxes. He achieved that relatively quickly, to everyone's surprise.
And who saw presidents fall.
The Lewinsky story was a little different. Bill Clinton had signed a law making it much easier to bring these kinds of actions. So he was sort of caught up in his own problems of his making.
From a vantage point at the heart of the White House, that's Tales from the White House Press Pool, a series of special reports, all this week on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 9:42 in Berlin, 8:42 here in London, and 3:42 a.m. in New York City. The endeavours of one man have utterly changed the face of e-commerce. Jeff Bezos started as a successful retailer of books online, but his ambition was to turn his company, Amazon, into the everything store. In less than two decades, he achieved just that and built a company that now employs almost 90,000 people and last year sold more than $61 billion worth of goods. Now, a new book charts the rise of this very private man and the company built on a corporate culture of secrecy and relentless ambition.
Well, joining us on the line is Brad Stone, author of The Everything Store and now winner of the Financial Times Goldman Sachs Business Book of the Year Award worth £30,000. Brad, thanks very much for joining us. Congratulations, first of all. But was the win a surprise?
Surprised and honored. Thanks for having me on the show.
The judges who obviously think the book is fantastic, but they're clearly in disagreement with Mrs. Bezos, Mackenzie, who gave it a 1-star rating on Amazon and called it inaccurate. Do you feel she's at all justified?
Well, Amazon's a company that evokes lots of strong reactions. Obviously, lots of people who love the company, you know, its customers, obviously its investors, and also, you know, there's the opposite side of the spectrum. You know, talk to anyone in book publishing right now, and they don't love Amazon because it can be fairly ruthless. I knew I was never, in telling the Amazon story, going to make everybody happy. You know, it's a secretive company. You know, the Bezos family is private, but it's a company that's changing our world. So my job was to tell the story and talk to as many people as possible. And, you know, perhaps that they didn't love the book there in Seattle was an indication that maybe I did a good job.
Well, indeed, you did speak to a lot of people, 300, whilst researching the book, but not Bezos himself. Why?
Well, actually, I have talked to Jeff. I've covered Amazon for many years. I probably talked to him about a dozen times over the last 10 years. I went to meet with him to tell him I was doing the book. He was fairly supportive, opened up a lot of doors for me inside Amazon, allowed me to talk to members of his senior staff. But he did decline to reflect, and it's probably because he's you know, he's secretive and he doesn't want to reveal elements of his strategy, but he's also focused on the future. And Amazon is expanding right now in so many ways, into different countries, into different product categories, in new devices. He doesn't have a lot of time for reflection.
Now, you go into the past as well. You tracked down Bezos' lost father. Tell us about that journey.
Well, right, and perhaps that's another element of the story that they weren't pleased to see in the book. But, you know, I wanted to understand Jeff. He's changed our world, the way we shop and read. And like Steve Jobs and, you know, so many other business and political figures, there were some interesting elements to his early childhood. In his case, his parents were teenagers, and his father left his life when he was 3 years old. He ended up growing up with an incredible, adoptive father who was a Cuban immigrant. It has never been known what happened to his biological father. So I tracked the man down, and he was running a bike shop outside Phoenix, Arizona. And I walked into his store, and in fact, he hadn't known what had happened to his biological son. And I ended up telling this man that his son was one of the most successful people in the world.
That must have been an incredible moment. How did he take the news?
He was surprised. He had wondered his whole life what had happened to this child. And I think there was a fair amount of joy and relief that he had... You know, not only was he alive, but that he had turned out to be quite an extraordinary person.
Well, let's discuss the man he's become, because, as some have said, it's quite a vengeful portrait that you paint of him. But you seem to admire him, too. Do you like him?
Yeah, I never considered it vengeful. I felt like I wanted to, you know, illustrate his relentlessness and the extraordinary company that he's created. And like Steve Jobs at Apple or Larry Page at Google, he has very high standards, and he wants everyone around him to meet those standards and to think big and to take risks. And we see that reflected in Amazon's incredible growth. I do admire him. I know him as a business leader, and when I've talked to him, he's always pitching products. So I probably couldn't even say that I know him well enough, you know, personally, to make that kind of judgment. But I definitely admire what he's created.
The book's been described as inspirational and full of management lessons. So what are the top lessons for young entrepreneurs to take from this?
Well, the biggest lesson from Amazon, I think, is to be comfortable disrupting your own business and creating uncomfortable tensions within your own halls. And Amazon's done this again and again, you know, from its decision to allow third-party sellers to come onto the site and list their items right up against Amazon's own product sales. You know, that created incredible tensions within the company. And then the creation of the Kindle business, where Bezos basically told an executive, your job is to go and put all your colleagues out of business trying to create a digital reading device. And, you know, and it's one reason now why we consider Amazon to stand among Google and Apple in this race for the future and for digital devices and services, because he's been comfortable doing that.
How's your book selling on Amazon?
Well, I've been pleased to see that it's doing quite well, and you know, I'm obviously grateful for Amazon, even though they don't love the book, to be enthusiastically selling it.
Brad, once again, congratulations on your win, and thanks very much for talking to us here. That's Brad Stone, the author of The Everything Store, and of course, that book available with just one click on Amazon.com.
Well, before we leaf through the day's Italian front pages, time for some music, and this is Beirut with Postcards from Italy. I love this one.
Times we had, oh, when the wind would blow.
That was Beirut with Postcards from Italy. You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin, and Cordelia Lynch. And it's time now to leaf through the day's Italian front pages with Monocle's David Pleasant. Welcome, David.
Hello, Georgina.
There's just one story in town, and it's not a great one, is it? Tell us what's happening in Sardinia.
Yes, as the world heard yesterday, there was a cyclone that struck Sardinia, a very rare occurrence in Europe, cyclone being a kind of meteorological term for a severe storm that came up from Africa and hit Sardinia on Monday evening. Really, the press in Italy is kind of waking up to the various stories that are emerging from the island. La Repubblica is devoting some 10 pages of today's edition to the events. Mainly, the headline is The Drama of Sardinia Underwater. We were not warned, is one quote. And this kind of theme of whether there was sufficient warning given is a recurring one in a lot of the coverage.
I mean, is there a good early warning system in place that just happened to fail this time, or does it not exist?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think a storm or kind of a cyclone of this magnitude is very rare, so any kind of warning systems probably wouldn't be adequate to cope. But in the Unione Sarda, the main Sardinian daily, because this question was also raised at various points yesterday during the various media kind of announcements, and the head of the civil protection, Franco Gabrielli, states quite clearly that we should stop with these debates. Plenty of warning was given. There was 12 hours warning transmitted to all the communes of the island that were affected. I guess the only that there was little kind of detail in as to how severe the actual weather was to be. Perhaps that's why so many people were caught off guard. The death count is 16 this morning, so slightly less than yesterday. So some little bit of good news in that.
And to talk about the physical impact of Cyclone Cleopatra, as it's being called, really it's changed the geography of Sardinia in just a matter of hours.
Yeah, exactly. So just in terms of kind of figures, there was 6 months worth of precipitation rain in 24 hours fell on mainly the north of Sardinia. Vast amounts of bridges, roads destroyed, and also the urban areas also affected. And this is another issue also covered in La Repubblica. There's a piece here by Gavino Led, who's a writer, and he says, I mean, that the main kind of blame should be put on those who have long ignored building regulations and kind of construction violations. it says, as so many cities in Italy, Olbia, one of the cities affected, the houses were built, you know, kind of in a very unplanned fashion during the, you know, after the war.
How's the government reacting? What are they pledging to do?
Enrico Letta, the Prime Minister, was in Olbia yesterday, and it has to be noted just how quickly he responded. Yesterday morning, he made an announcement declaring a state of emergency, and a few hours later flew to Sardinia, where he made several announcements, including he said, I am here because I want to tell you that the state is here with you. We will never abandon you. So it's very kind of dramatic statements from the Prime Minister.
And of course, Sardinia, a very popular tourist destination, I'm sure concerns there for the impact it's going to have on the economy, not least.
Yeah, the level of destruction seems to be pretty wide. And I mean, there's no kind of indication of the amount that it's got, the cleanup's going to cost. But the state has already pledged some 20 million euros in support of those who the some 3,000 people who have been left homeless. It's kind of worth noting that this is really the tourist area. Costa Smeralda, just outside of Olbia, is the area that a lot of people know of for the kind of billionaires' yachts and so on. And the economy is very much based on that tourism.
David, thank you very much indeed.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Tom Lewis, our researcher, Alexa Firmanich, Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, and Rosie Celis. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. And stay tuned for the briefing at noon, when Marcus will be back with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, at noon, London time, and 7 in New York. They'll be live from Copenhagen as part of the Monocle Guide to Better Living book tour. And Ty Genwright and Victoria Graham will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.